Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did African Americans in the 20th century change their individual destinies when they fled southern states to move north or west? And how did that massive exodus change the country as a whole? Nearly 6 million black Americans made such journeys between 1915 and 1970 in search of better education, better job opportunities, and communities where they could expect their full rights as U.S. citizens to be acknowledged and protected. The extent to which those dreams did and did not come true is the subject of the award-winning book The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. It's out now in paperback, and author Isabel Wilkerson is professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. She won a Pulitzer Prize for feature reporting during her tenure with the New York Times, and we are delighted she could be with us today. Isabel, welcome to Think.
Oh, great to be here.
You have called this the biggest underreported story of the 20th century. Why has the Great Migration not received the attention it deserves, given its huge impact on so many aspects of American life?
I think there are so many reasons why. The two main reasons are that, first of all, it was so big that it was almost hard to capture while it was underway, because you're talking 6 million people who were part of this great migration. It began during World War One, and at each turn, each decade, people thought it would end, and it didn't. It continued on. So it was really hard to capture while it was underway. But I think that one of the main reasons that it became an underreported story is because the people did not talk about it. Mm. It's as if they had experienced such heartache, longing, homesickness, that they often didn't tell their own children and grandchildren about what they had endured. And when they left, many of them left for good and didn't look back, and it's as if they started their lives anew and really didn't share the stories with their own families.
What was it, Isabel, about those early years of the 20th century that triggered the Great Migration?
Well, in some ways, this migration, which involved, as you said, 6 million African Americans, who essentially were defecting a caste system that's hard for us to imagine now. Mm-hmm. They were almost seeking political asylum within the borders of their own country. It started during World War One, because during World War One, the North had a problem, and that was it needed cheap labor to replace the labor that it had lost during the war in Europe. And so they began to, the railroads, the steel mills, the factories, and the foundries began to look to the cheapest labor in the land, which was African Americans in the South, many of whom were working merely for the right to live on the land that they were farming. They were sharecroppers. And so that's what began this great migration.
And a lot of Southern jurisdictions resisted this with almost any tactic they could.
You know, what happened was the North came recruiting African Americans. So the first wave of people who left the South came at the express invitation of people in the North. But the South didn't take very kindly to this poaching of their cheap labor, and so it began to do whatever it could. Many people began to do whatever they could to keep this labor from leaving, and so they would actually arrest people on the railroad platforms. They would arrest people from their train seats. And when there were too many people to arrest, they would wave the train on through, so that people who had been waiting for so long for the chance to get to what they perceived as freedom had to watch the train leave without them.
So, Isabel, I think that we are all aware of the shameful history in this country of separate drinking fountains and public bathrooms and restaurant counters in the Jim Crow South. I have to tell you, I was astonished to read about separate hospitals and staircases and Bibles in county courthouses.
I found it astonishing. And as I've gone and talked about this book, one of the most common reactions to the stories within it are from people who might have lived during that era or might be descended from people who were from that era, and just would say, I had no idea. That's the most common reaction. And that's partly because to recreate what that world was like, which is the goal of the book, to help people understand why they might have made this decision, I looked for all the examples of what it was like to live in what was essentially an artificial hierarchy, a caste system. And, you know, it was actually against the law in Birmingham for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together. And in courtrooms throughout the South, there was actually a black Bible and a separate and different white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in court.
It's hard to imagine living in a world like that. I want to talk about this because growing up, you had a sense that your family's own story was somehow disconnected from the interesting migration stories of your classmates whose families had come, say, from other countries.
That is so true, actually. I think that the genesis of this book came when I was in elementary school in Washington, D.C., and I have found myself gravitating toward children who happen to be recent immigrants, the children of immigrants. And I didn't have a context for it at that time. I just realized that I didn't feel the same connection to people who've been in the North for a long time. And it turned out that I actually had a lot in common with those children. And that was because we were both returning to homes where the food was different from that we were experiencing whenever we would go to school. Mm-hmm. I was being raised by two Southerners who were speaking a little bit differently from those around me in school, who were sending me to school with lunch boxes that were different from, the food was different from what other kids had, and were raising us raising me and other people like me in a very strict Southern valued way. In other words, I was being raised by Southerners in a place far from where they were from, and trying to negotiate two worlds as the children of immigrants do. And so that's the reason why I see this connection between the experiences of people who were part of this great migration and those of anyone who might have crossed the Atlantic in steerage or the Pacific Ocean or the Rio Grande to get to this country. I feel that there's this common story, and the people in this book are proxies for what people in all of our backgrounds had to have done for us to be here.
Overall, were the African Americans who left the South during the Great Migration demographically very different from the folks who stayed behind?
Yes, that's one of the things that the more recent research that demographers and sociologists are beginning to find about it. It's still being there's still an attempt to understand this migration because it was such a watershed event in American history. And what we're finding is that the people in this migration, like any migration, tend to be different from those who stay and those that they meet upon arrival. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be greater risk takers. They often tend to be better educated than those that they leave behind. They often are better educated than those that they meet upon arrival. However, they're often misunderstood, as many immigrants are, meaning they don't quite easily translate their previous experience into the new place because there's so much competition. There's the issue of language and accent and the way one carries oneself. So they had a lot of adjustments to make.
And they weren't necessarily welcomed with open arms by African Americans who had been in these northern Western cities.
It's interesting that with any migration, all kinds of issues arise as a result of the introduction of new people or the departure of people who had been in another place. And a lot of it gets down to a sense of insecurity, economic insecurity, and a sense of threat from the arrival of people who there's a fear will provide competition for work. And because they have so much at stake, they really, you know, for an immigrant or a migrant, failure is not an option. They have no place else to turn. They can't go back home, so they have to succeed, and they're often willing to take two and three jobs, and they're willing to maybe take a little lower pay in order to make ends meet. And so that causes a lot of competition and threat. And so when they arrived in these big cities of the North, in New York or Chicago or Philadelphia, they often were met with a tremendous amount of resistance and resentment by those who were already there.
Isabel Wilkerson is my guest. She's professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. She won a Pulitzer Prize for feature reporting during her tenure with the New York Times. And her book, out now in paperback, is called The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. We'll come back to our talk with Isabel in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is here now, senior producer of Think, and of course the host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And I think everyone wants to know right now where we are on this mini goal.
I want to know.
I want to know too. And we have an update. Look, folks, it's going great. Thanks so much to everyone who's called, everyone who's contributed during the Think show today. Our overall goal for the show today, $16,000. What that does, that keeps the station and the drive on track to end today. Yes, we've been promising to end tomorrow and give you back 4 days of programming without interruption, but we can end it today if we can stay on track. And the great news is, when we last spoke to you, we said there were $8,600 or so left to raise. Chris, What's that new number?
It is $5,780. I have to tell you, Jeff, I'm almost getting choked up here. To raise $16,000 in the 2 hours of Think is a very ambitious goal for us. And you all have stepped up in a way that is really, really wonderful because of your love for public radio, but because of your belief that this resource should be available in this community. We so appreciate the fact that you take the time, that you spend the money to make sure that this resource is still available. To not just rely and hope that someone else will do it, but to do it yourself. Thank you so much for your contributions.
Well, and yes, thank you so much. And of course, it's not over yet. There's still $112,000 left to raise in the overall campaign. We're trying to do that by 7 o'clock today so that we don't have to interrupt any of your programs tomorrow. When you tune into Morning Edition tomorrow, you'll just hear Sam Baker. You won't hear me. You won't hear Jeff Ramirez. You'll hear Sam Baker.
Not that we don't love you, but we want Sam.
Right. I want Sam, too. I want to wake up to Sam like I do every single day. You know, we all want the drive to end sooner too. And that's why we're offering you this opportunity today to wrap it up. $111,000 left to raise. Chris, the listeners have contributed, if you've contributed today, over $70,000 today. It's been an incredible day, but we want to continue. And if you have not yet made your contribution, this is your chance right now. Just $5,780 left to raise during Think Today to stay on track to finish the drive today. And we do have copies of Isabel Wilkerson's book that's now out in paperback, The Warmth of Other Suns.
We're going to get to this in the next segment, but this is also, it's a lot of great demographic and historical information. There are stories in here of three real people that are absolutely captivating, and the people are unforgettable. I feel like I'll be telling their stories based on Isabel's book for a long time. It is a really great work of American history. If you'd like to receive a copy and also support KERA at or above the $120 level, have we got a deal for you? Just go online to KERA.org, make that contribution there, or do it over the phone at 1-888-694-6931.
You can get your very own copy of The Warmth of Other Suns at the $120 or higher membership level today. Just $10 a month. When you become a sustaining member, you can put that on a credit card or your debit card, and the $10 automatically comes out every month. You know that your membership is always current. You set it and forget it, as Chris likes to say, when you become a sustaining member of the station. And for just $10 a month, you can support the station all year long, and we'll send you a copy of the book with our thanks.
Thank you so much, Dana Callahan in Dallas. Thank you, Stephanie and Robert Doss in Carrollton. Big thanks to Meredith Morris in Segoville and Diana Sobey in Dallas. Thanks also Jacqueline Loran in Richardson, Kathy Kuhn in Allen, and Deborah Cascino in Weatherford, also Summer Badgett in Hearst. Really appreciate your contributions. $5,780 left to raise in this hour to make our goal for Think and keep us on track to end the drive at the end of today.
Yeah, we know that many of you are listening, but you know that a lot of folks listen to the station because we tell you all the time, and you probably think, well, somebody else will do it. Well, what if they don't? What if they don't make the call? It's really up to you, and we really just need a few dozen of you to join at this $120 membership level, and we'll knock out this goal for Think Today. We'll be able to set the stage for the rest of the programs today to pull in what's necessary to finish the drive today. That's what we're trying to do right now. Stay on track to finish the drive 5 days earlier than normal. We're going to give you back an extra day of programming, 5 whole days of your favorite radio shows. All you got to do is get on board right now. Call 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org.
It only takes a couple of minutes of your time. The money is up to you. But the great thing about a sustaining membership, if that's what you want to do, is that you can really give a substantial amount of money and hardly feel it at all in your budget. Even a contribution of $360 a year is $30 a month, less than a lot of us pay for a lot of other sources of media. Please go online now to KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931.
1-888-694-6931. That's the number. Again, it's 1-888-694-6931. Just $5,780 left to raise during Think Today by 2 p.m., and we make the goal to keep the drive on track to finish today. You can also help out by clicking and joining online at KERA.org, and thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Isabel Wilkerson. She's professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. She's also the author of the award-winning book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration, which has just been released in paperback. If you'd like to join our conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Isabel, as I mentioned in the fundraising break, this is not simply a story with a bunch of facts and figures, but it's a story about real people. I want to go first to the exhaustive research process for you, because it sounds like you traveled all over the country and left no class reunion or ladies' guild meeting or funeral unturned looking for people to talk to.
That is so true. You know, I worked on this book for 15 years. If it were a human being, it would be in high school and dating. That's how much time it took. And I that's a good thing I didn't know when I went into it, because I don't know that I would have embarked upon it. But it ended up being that I interviewed over 1,200 people, to narrow it down to three amazing people who are beautifully imperfect, as all of us are, and were willing to tell their stories and share them with me. And those three people represent the 6 million and ultimately the, you know, the ancestors of so many of us who came from so far away in order to get to this country. And it's through their eyes and their hearts and their spirit that one gets to see what would it be like to be in their shoes, to make the decision of your life to leave the only place that you've ever known for a place far, far away that you've never seen in hopes that life might be better. And so it follows the three migration streams which the people used in order to find what they perceived as freedom. There was the first stream that carried people from Georgia, Florida, the Carolinas, and Virginia to Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia, and New York, and the Northeast. There was the middle stream, which carried people from Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, and Tennessee to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and the Midwest. And then there was a stream that carried people from Louisiana and Texas to California and the entire West Coast. And it's through these three individuals that you get a chance to live through and see what it was like to be these people.
So tell us about Ida Mae Gladney. She and her husband were sharecroppers in Mississippi and left for Chicago essentially because they realized it wasn't safe for them to stay.
That's a really good way of putting it. She is, to me, interesting because she had the misfortune of being a sharecropper's wife who was terrible at picking cotton. You don't think of people being good or bad at it, but it so happens that there are people who were not good at it at all.
Well, it's hard work, too.
It's very hard work. I mean, the standard was to pick 100 pounds of cotton, which, believe it or not, meant that one had to pick 7,000 balls of cotton. You think of a cotton ball or a Q-tip and how little it weighs. Well, that's why it was so much, it was such hard work, and they had to do that day in and day out, and she just had a really hard time being able to meet that quota. But they left because a cousin of her husband's had been, really, he'd been beaten to within an inch of his life over a theft that he had not committed. The thing that they thought he had stolen turned up the next day. There were no apologies in order. That's just the kind of thing that would happen in the caste system that they were consigned to. And her husband decided that that was the last crop they would make. And they had to set out to divest of what little they had. They could only tell two people in their entire family. She said that when you were about to leave, you didn't tell people you were gone until you were gone.
And it wasn't necessarily as easy for women who moved to find jobs as it was for men.
It's interesting that you make note of that, because the migration really was spurred by the need for labor in the North and also the West that was based upon having a hard back, I mean, meaning a strong back, people who would work in the foundries and the steel mills, and there was not as much work for the women to do, and they had a very hard time. Once they got North, they were often competing against other women from other immigrant streams, and they were all competing to work as domestics or to what little labor there was available for women. And it turned out that in many of these big cities, African-American women in particular were reduced to having to compete against one another on the corners of major streets where they would bid against one another in order to be hired by the housewives in the north to scrub their floors and clean their bathrooms, whatever it might have taken. So many of those women ended up making less than they would have been making had they stayed in the South, picking the tobacco or whatever it might have been in those early going years of their arrival.
And, you know, I have to tell you, Isabel, reading that, it sounded very familiar to me because, as I'm sure you're aware, in a lot of cities in Texas and other places along the southern border, this is exactly the situation that you have with Mexican immigrants trying to work as day laborers, men in most cases, but
you
still.
You do. You see the people gathering together in pre-assigned or areas where they know everyone knows where to go to find them. And it's interesting to see this recreation of that same system recreated decades later by a new wave of people. It's just the kind of thing that happens when people migrate.
So tell us about George Starling. He had, in fact, had some college education because of the economic and social situation at the time. He wasn't able to finish, but applied his talents trying to help citrus growers organize to have better pay, safer working conditions, and therefore found himself targeted for lynching.
Absolutely. He was someone who had a college, partial college education, just enough for him to recognize that the people were being cheated. And as he attempted to try to organize them to stand up for their rights, he was directly confronting the caste system that was not ready for that kind of behavior on the part of an African American at that time. And so he was targeted for lynching, and he had to literally flee for his life from Florida to New York in order to escape a lynching that had been planned for him, because he was really going up against the system that I've described.
Talk about why you use this phrase caste system instead of what is more commonly used, racism.
I purposely chose to use the word caste system because it challenges us to think differently about what we think we know.
Mm-hmm.
And it provides a structure for understanding how and why people were categorized in the ways that they were, and that it was an economically driven system that required that there be not just a supply of cheap labor, but an oversupply of cheap labor that would have no options to leave in order to maintain the economy of the South, the cotton, the tobacco, the rice, and the sugarcane that were the lifeblood of the South, and that required a tremendous amount of labor, very labor-intensive work, in order to maintain that system. And the idea of a caste system helps us to think differently about what we think we know. The task of this is to allow ourselves to imagine what it would like to be in that world. What would we have done? What the book asks, and this whole story asks, what would you have done had you been in the situation that these people were in? And it asks the reader, regardless of your own background, to think about the sacrifices that had to have been made for you to exist here today at this place on the soil at this time.
So the third anchor for this narrative is a fascinating character, Dr. Robert Foster, who would have seemed at the outset to have been in the best position to actually thrive, even remaining in the South. He came from a prominent family. He had an MD, but he really couldn't make a go of it there in the same way that he could if he left.
Yes, he actually, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, was a surgeon in the Army during the Korean conflict. When he got out of the Army, it turned out that he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana. And so he decided that he would set out for a place where he thought he could be the physician that he'd wanted to become. And so he decided to go to California, which would have been the stream that would have carried many people from Texas. There's hardly anyone in Texas or Louisiana that doesn't have relatives in California. And that's the stream that he decided to follow. But it turned out that he had a precarious journey trying to get there, and had not anticipated the resistance that he would run into as he tried to make his way through the desert and the mountains to get to the West. And he found that he could not stop for a place to rest for the night for three states of the West, which is a really long way. Mm. And I attempted to recreate that journey myself by renting a Buick, as he had, and trying to experience what he'd experienced so that the reader could know what it was like to be in his shoes.
And it was excruciating for you, even knowing that if you chose to, you could have sort of broken off and stopped anywhere you wanted.
You're right. It was artificial to begin with because, of course, at any given moment I could have stopped. I had my parents with me, and they were people who had been part of this great migration. And at a certain point, we were getting to the part where the land gets particularly vicious, you know, with the hairpin curves. And I was so tired. I had not slept, as he had not been able to sleep. And it was darkness, and you couldn't see where you were going. And I began to fall asleep at the wheel. And my parents said, you have to stop the car. Stop the car or let us out, because this is unsafe. We'll tell you what you need to know, but let us out. And so we stopped in Yuma, Arizona, where, of course, we had no trouble finding a place because it was no longer 1953, and the country has really changed so much since that time in our history.
So what sort of reception did Foster have when he went to practice medicine in California?
He found that he had a really difficult time getting situated because of what we had talked about earlier, which has to do with the fact that he was arriving to a place where he didn't know anyone, and he had to start from the ground up, and he had a very difficult go of it trying to get adjusted. The people who were already there did not open their doors to him initially, which is what immigrants often have to go through. And that's the reason why I make a connection between the immigrant experience and that of African-Americans in this great migration. Because remember, many of these people, he was not quite as he was not in this position as many of them were, but many of them had never been outside the county, the rural county in the South that they had been born in. And they found themselves in these big, forbidding, anonymous cities where life was extremely difficult and challenging and much more expensive than they had anticipated, and they had a very difficult go of it. The fact that they survived at all is in some ways a testament to the human spirit.
So it's probably unexpected that we would have any comic relief in an hour like this one, Isabel, but we're going to end this part of the conversation with a little clip from a Ray Charles song, who was the most famous patient of Dr. Foster. Can you set up the song for us?
Yes, Dr. Foster ended up being the physician to one of the famous migrants from the South, which is Ray Charles. And Ray Charles ended up devoting a song to Dr. Foster, and it's called Hide Nor Hair.
Well, I called my Dr. Foster, and when the girl answered the phone, I got a funny feeling the way she said Dr. Foster had gone. She said he left with a lady patient about 24 hours ago. I added two and two, and here's what I got. I got I'll never see that girl no more. Well, I ain't seen her, now have my baby, since that day, yeah. But I ain't seen her, now have my baby, since she went away. If Dr. Foster has got her, then I know I'm through, because he's got medicine and money too. I ain't seen hide my hair, now baby, since that day. Oh, no.
That was Ray Charles singing Hide Nor Hair. We will get a little more backstory from Isabel Wilkerson, our guest, after this break. Isabel's book is called The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. It's now out in paperback. If you would like to be part of the conversation, call us at 800-933-5372. If you are ready to help us reach our goal for the 2 hours of Think Today, we really need to hear from you online at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington has joined me in the studio now. Do you have an update on our goal?
Yeah, Chris, our goal for the show today, $16,000 in the 2 hours of Think. And great news, $4,435. We're getting an update as I speak. Actually, $3,705 left to raise.
Fantastic.
In the show today. Your call right now to 1-888-694-6931. Your online contribution at kera.org will make it happen. I want to thank Dolly Christensen in Dallas, Natalie Probst in Plano, Myron and Danielle Hester in Southlake, Kathy Hamilton in Southlake, also Elizabeth Garner in Richardson, Mary Westman in Mesquite, and Zachary Bell in Plano. They all did their part, either on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. That's 1-888-694-6931. 6931, or they went online, they clicked, they joined at kera.org.
We have copies available of Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, available as thank you gifts at the $120 level or above. This is another one on that list that I have to tell you, I mean, you should read it anyway, and if you want to get it while you support us, fantastic. I cannot recommend it enough. It's mm-hmm. not only really interesting, but it is a just a phenomenal read. It's enjoyable to sit through it and get all this great information through the stories of people that we come to really care about and relate to.
It's a great opportunity for you to get a great book and also to support your favorite radio station. And, you know, if you go out and pick up the book, it's out in paperback, as we said earlier, The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. If you go out and pick it up at the bookstore or you get it online, that's fine too. But we hope that you'll support KERA today. And we're just offering you the chance to get a copy of the book with our thanks when you support the station with a contribution of at least $120. $3,066 left to raise by 2 p.m. to stay on track. What are we staying on track for?
We are staying on track for a total of $16,000 during Think Today, and we are really staying on track to end the drive mm-hmm. tonight.
Our original plan was to give you back 4 days, days that would have normally been used, like last fall, during the membership campaign, to give you back 4 days pledge-free if we ended the drive and made the goal of $700,000 by tomorrow evening. Well, we looked at how things were going, and late yesterday and early this morning, the decision was made by upper-level management to go for it today because we've actually heard from so many of you, and thank you so much, that we are well within striking distance of finishing this membership campaign today.
It really is phenomenal, the support that you show this station that you love so much. We know how much you care about KERA. We know that you want us to succeed. If you want the station to succeed but somehow have never quite found it to get up and make a phone call or go online to KERA.org, please make today the day that you initiate a membership. You can do it by a sustaining membership, which is only a little bit out of your checking or your debit card or your credit card every month, or you can do it all in one lump sum. It's entirely up to you. You can call in to 1-888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org.
If you're just getting back to the office from lunch, don't get out of the car just yet. Before you get out of the car, turn your phone on, call 888-694-6931 and make a contribution before you go back in, to the busyness of your afternoon at the office. Make that call right now before you head back into work because you believe in KERA. You want it to succeed. You want it to continue to succeed here. And we still need to raise $2,846 by 2 p.m. to stay on track for a successful conclusion of this membership campaign today.
Love to see that number dropping. I would love to get us into the positive territory so we go over the 16,000. It is certainly possible given how much many of you love not only this show but the station as a whole. Your contribution now keeps it strong and vibrant. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can go online to kera.org. And remember, if you're interested, we have copies available of Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, as thank you gifts when you join us at or above the $120 level. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with author Isabel Wilkerson. Her book is called The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. If you want to join in, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we heard that song, Isabel, and it may have been vaguely embarrassing for Dr. Foster, but in fact it was really good for business.
Well, the thing is that he actually was quite a character. He was a physician, clearly, but he also was a person who was beloved by people who were from the humbler stratas of southern experience. And he was extremely popular, which is one of the reasons that he ended up getting Ray Charles as one of his patients. He actually became this gambling physician. He hung out with blues singers and people who were people who would bet on the horses. I mean, he was quite the character, not what you would expect of a staid physician at all. And so the character that's being described in the song of Ray Charles is actually not so far from reality. I actually checked with Dr. Foster before writing that song and recording it, and Dr. Foster thought it was a hoot and went along with it.
So there were people, as you mentioned, that sort of moved out of the South and started over and never looked back. And there were others who sought out the company of people who they might have known back home or who might have had, you know, common friends and relatives back home. Did either of those two ways of handling being in these new places have an impact on how people did overall?
That is such a great question. I mean, one of the things that I discovered and found so inspiring in a way is the fact that many of them recreated, to the degree that they could, little colonies of home, mm-hmm. which is what, you know, immigrants do. And when you go to Chicago, for example, there are multiple Mississippi clubs from Greenwood, Mississippi, and Grenada, Mississippi, and Greenville, Mississippi, and Newton, Mississippi. So there are all these different Mississippi clubs. In California, there are multiple Texas clubs. Dr. Foster himself was part of the Monroe, Louisiana Club. And I would say that actually in looking at all of their experiences, it became clear to me that those who actually made out the best were those who found a way to incorporate the best of where they had come from, the culture and values of the place that they had come from in the South, along with the best of the things that they could incorporate from the North and the West, the new places, their adopted homelands. And those are the ones who found a way to adjust the best, because they had not given up all that they'd had before, and they found a way to enjoy the best of what they had in the new place.
So in many places in the North and West, there weren't codified segregation laws, but people found that they were not, in fact, welcomed. Their presence was discouraged in neighborhoods by European American residents who'd been there.
You're absolutely right. They had resistance from many different directions, from African Americans who were there already and who were feeling a sense of unease about the arrival of the people from what they considered the rural areas and somewhat country people. And then there was the resistance that they had from people who also were recent immigrants, but from other parts of the world, mm-hmm. who were just making their own adjustment and still getting a toehold in this new place. And there were all kinds of barriers to their being able to get situated. One of them was that there were these restrictive covenants, which meant that many white homeowners who might have wanted to sell to them were forbidden from doing so because there were these restrictive covenants that dictated that they could not sell to African Americans. In other cases where these people who had come up from the South tried to move into neighborhoods where they had formerly not been, there were firebombings and other attacks on them whenever they tried to get into these other neighborhoods. So they had a really difficult go of it.
To what extent does the loss through the Great Migration of the least risk-averse, in some cases most ambitious, members of African-American communities in the South account for the enduring poverty in the Deep South that lasted longer than it did in many other rural areas, rather, in the country?
I think that one of the things that we've learned is that you have to be extremely motivated in order to pick yourself up and leave the only place you've ever known for someplace far away. And I think it does leave devastation. I mean, one of the things is there was a depopulation of the countryside overall, and that happened in the South as well. In other words, people were leaving the smaller towns for the big cities, such as Houston and Atlanta and Charlotte, and that happened throughout the South. And so that there was the effect of that, but there also was the effect of people who had a tremendous sense of ambition, being willing to leave it all and take this great risk. And when people do that, they're often doing it not for themselves but for their children. I mean, one of the enduring legacies of this migration is that this was the very first time in American history that people who had been at the lowest caste in this country, and they were concentrated in the South as a by definition, where they actually had the first chance for a new generation to live out their God-given talents, which had been there all along but had been held back and repressed by the caste system that they were held under. And that meant that you had the opportunities for people such as Toni Morrison, who would never have become could not have become the novelist that she had become had her parents not left Alabama and gone to Ohio, because it would have been illegal for her to go into a library and just take out a library book. But by going to Ohio, her parents gave her the opportunity, and so many other people gave their children the opportunity to get an education and to get access to things that they never would have had had these people stayed.
And the migration also added a really remarkable cultural and ethnic and social diversity to cities in the North and West that had before been pretty much lily white.
That is such a great point. In other words, in some ways, this is the greatest transfer of Southern culture that had occurred in our country's history, because people who, you know, 6 million people who were part of this migration at the time that it started, there were fewer than 10 million African Americans in the entire country, 90% of them in the South. So this was a huge transfer of Southern culture. And the people carried with them the folk ways and the folk music and art and culture with them. So they carried with them the blues and the spirituals and the gospel music, and then their children converted it into whole new art forms such as jazz and, you know, and Motown, neither of which would have existed had there been no great migration. A couple of examples are Miles Davis, whose parents migrated from Arkansas to Southern Illinois. Had they not done that, he would not have had the opportunity, the luxury really, of being able to spend the hours upon hours it would take to perfect his, you know, the talent that he already had. And Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated from North Carolina to New York when he was 5. He, too, got the luxury of being able to learn music in a way that he never would have in the tobacco country of North Carolina. And then John Coltrane, he migrated at the age of 16 from North Carolina to Philadelphia, where, believe it or not, it was there in Philadelphia that he got his first alto sax. And one has to wonder what would jazz be, what would music be, had there been no migration of these, just these three people alone. And then you add others such as Motown, which would not have existed had there been no great migration. So, you know, this was a sea change in culture, 20th century culture as we know it.
So you were clearly deep into the research, if not the writing of the book, when Hurricane Katrina happened. I wonder if you noted any parallels in that diaspora, which in some cases was temporary and in some cases it turned out to be permanent.
Well, actually, I ended up taking a little break from the book in order to cover part of the Katrina experience, and I actually followed some people who had left, who had been actually transported out, airlifted out of New Orleans into Oklahoma, where they were very much like the people in this book. I mean, they found themselves in, you know, a very different place, an alien place that where they had to make a way for themselves. So I do see parallels, because they were Southerners who were spread out in a diaspora all over the country.
Most surprising thing that you learned in this book, even having gone into it a well-educated person?
I think that one of the most surprising things I found was the similarity to the, you know, immigrant experience of other people. In other words, the idea that people who migrate kind of share similar sense of dislocation, of longing, of homesickness, but this drive to make it in this new place without much in the way of backup, but also kind of a sense of sadness over the fact that these people coming from all over the world, and then those coming from the South who were so similar. They were the same people of the land who were arriving in these big forbidding cities, and how they were kind of pitted against one another. I think that I leave it with a sense of both hopefulness that we actually do have so much more in common than we've been led to believe, and also a sense of there's a lesson here that we, you know, if we can just see how much we have in common, you know, a lot of these the differences that we perceive or think are so important actually are quite small, that we all kind of want and are seeking the same thing.
Isabel Wilkerson, it's been such a pleasure to have you on this hour. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The book by Isabel Wilkerson is called The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. It is available now in paperback. It is also available as a thank you gift when you join the station today at or above the $120 level. We, in order to make our goal for the 2 hours of Think Today, we have to raise an additional $1,826 by the end end of the hour. We definitely can do it. If you jump in now and make that difference for us, please don't assume that someone else will make the call, because if everybody listening does that, we won't make the goal. But your contribution now will take us that much closer. Please go online to KERA.org or call in to 1-888-694-6931. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. And hello to you. Just $1,826 left to raise to reach our $16,000 goal for Think Today. Please don't wait. Please do it right now. If you've considered becoming a friend of the station, that's a $1,500 or more contribution. That would be really handy right now to help Think. And, you know, if everything goes well today, if we make this goal and we make the next goal, et cetera, this would be your last chance to support the Think Show during the fall membership campaign this year. So this would be a great chance right now for you to help us knock a big chunk off the $109,000, just $109,000 that's left to raise in the entire membership campaign. The number to call, it's 888-694-6931. Again, it's 1-888-694-6931.
The reasons for supporting public radio are vast and varied, but you know why you listen. You know why the programming is important to you, and therefore you must understand why we need to raise the money to support this station through contributions from people just like you who listen, who care about the programming, and who want everything to work. Please go online now to KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931. You can also go to the website at KERA.org.
Just $1,465 left to raise. Again, a friend's contribution of $1,500 would put us over the top for this hour. Again, just $1,465 left to raise. That's just 15 people making a $100 contribution. If you can make a $100 contribution to the station right now, you'll help us wrap up this hour of Think by making the goal, staying on track to not finish the drive tomorrow, to finish the drive today. We've been saying it all day. I was here a few minutes before 6 this morning. We went on the air with a goal of finishing this drive. And here's what's really crazy, Chris. We started this morning with $184,000 left to raise. There's just $109,000 left to raise right now. And we're just about halfway through the day. So we can totally do this. Only if, though, you will make the next one, be the next one to make the call, or click and join online at KERA.org.
If you want to read Isabel Wilkerson's book, please consider the $120 membership thank you that we have available. We have copies of The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. That is available when you join at or above the $120 level. We have lots of other thank you gifts, including that wonderful Homesick Texan cookbook that we had Lisa Fain on for last week.
That's been very popular.
It's been very popular. It's really a beautiful cookbook. Or maybe you make a $240 contribution and say, I want both of those books. We can make that happen for you. We know a lot of you don't take a thank you gift at all, or don't do this for the thank you gifts. In fact, I would say no one who makes a contribution does it for the thank you gift. You do it because you love public radio. But listen, if this is the way to sweeten the deal and to make you say, all right, I'll actually pull out that credit card, I will get out my checkbook, please don't let us stop you. Take a thank you gift and take it with our compliments.
Yeah, and you know, the best thing that you get is, and you already know this, it's what you get on KERA every single day. If when you turn on your car, when you get in the car to go home from the office this afternoon or to run some errands, no matter where you're going, if the very next thing you hear after the engine coming on is KERA, then KERA deserves your support. If the first thing you hear in the morning when the alarm goes off is KERA, well, then KERA deserves your support. If you've been listening long enough to remember coverage of you know, the election in 2008 when Obama was elected president, but you have not yet given to the station, KERA Today deserves your contribution.
If you are the only, if this is the only station programmed into your car, so if when someone else comes in and asks to listen to another station, you say, I don't have any others, this is the time for you to make your contribution online at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. By the end of the hour, we are looking to raise an additional $1,465. Perfect time if you are a Friends level member or considering such a membership to come in, swoop in, sort of allow Think to make its goal, and also provide yourself and your community with another year of great radio.
And it gets us so much closer to just having about $100,000 left to raise, which is doable this afternoon because so many of you have joined today. So many more people who listen in the afternoon are going to step up and help out. It's a fact that most people join the station on the last day. More people join the station on the last day than almost any other day of the drive. But you know what? That's okay, because today's the last day. Today can be the last last day if we just stay on track. And it's just, we're getting an update right now. We did
receive
a friend's contribution.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, which means that we did accomplish our goal.
We accomplished our goal, but let's push it forward since the drive is not over. We would love to continue going into positive territory as we, as Jeff and I are talking to you. So please don't stop now if you were thinking about making a contribution. We still have that additional 108,000 something left to raise by the end of the day to end the drive.
Well, and the world, which comes up next, and we'll talk about that in a moment, Chris, after NPR News headlines, followed by us and then followed by the world. The goal for the world today, $10,000 by 3 o'clock. So let's go ahead and start working on that. If you're a fan of the world, if you like the show, call now, 888-694-6931, or click and join at KERA.org.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.